At this point, with the global seed supply, and Monsanto today is, of course, as you know, a major actor in global seed supply, the districts I have visited where there has been seed failure of up to 90% for a number of reasons. First, because the entry of corporations into agriculture in third world societies, very recent, it's come with globalization. It's come not by itself, it's come with a lot of coercion. In our case, it was the structural adjustment programs of the World Bank in 1988 in the agricultural sector that specifically told India that we couldn't get further loans if we didn't allow seed multinationals to enter the Indian market. And that's how Cargill and Monsanto and at that time Novartis and Ciba-Geigy, but later combined into Sandoz and Ciba-Geigy, which combined into Novartis. That's how they entered. Now, when they start selling seeds, they sell hybrid seeds. They don't sell open pollinated varieties that farmers can save. And they never tell the farmers, you can't save the seed. Farmers then plant out the hybrid next year and have very high rates of seed failure. But it's also happening that because they are grabbing markets so fast, very often there is, in any case, very high levels of sterility in the seed because they use male sterile lines. And the third reason for very high levels of seed failure is because on very large scales, the same seed is being distributed. We have had different cotton varieties for the black cotton soils in the Deccan area of India, different varieties for Punjab. Now the same variety is sold around the country. First of all, it starts to displace local crops. Secondly, it's totally ill-adapted to the particular ecosystem. On the one hand, India is such a diverse region. When you're harvesting in one place, you're starting to sow in the next. And if you've planted one crop, one variety around the country, you can be absolutely sure the rains are coming for the wrong time for it somewhere in the country. So you lose crops because of untimely rain. You lose crops because the hybrids are very, very pest prone. The region in central India where we've had the far highest number of farmer suicides, and you must remember India is that country which used to be considered so laid back because of its our philosophy of karma, that, you know, nothing in this life could ever be a total disaster because there are always other lives. And yet even Indian peasants who believe in the next life are committing suicide because debt has become so unpayable in the new context. They used to have debt earlier, but it used to be the kind of debt they knew they could pay off with a little hard work. They could pay off with going off into the city for a migratory job and coming back. The debt today is so high. It's 200,000 rupees, 300,000 rupees for peasants who have no capital. And they know within a year or two, when they accumulate that kind of debt, they'll never be able to pay back. Where's the debt coming from? It's coming from seed that's costing 100,000 to 200,000 rupees per kilogram, depending on what you're planting. Seed that used to be free, it used to be theirs. Pesticides, which each time, the more they use, the more they have to use. 12 sprays, 15 sprays, 20 sprays. Pesticide use in just the last 5 years in large areas of India have shot up by 2,000%. That's what free market and globalization has brought. And since we are talking about peasants who have no money, who have no capital, they can only buy expensive seeds and expensive pesticides by borrowing. And who lends that money? The same companies that sell the pesticides, which are the same companies that sell the seeds, as you know, are now also the major creditors. And interest rates are shooting up to 150%. Some places 200%. That is behind farmer suicides. Those are stories one never hears about in the international media. But it is the underside of globalization that is not just an accident. It's predictable, it's growing. And unless we start to see what's happening on a very, very large scale around the world, the farmer suicides in India will just be the trend of the annihilation of life across the board. Globalization has very often been called an inevitable phenomena. That's the way it was always described. Sometimes they refer to globalization as the fact that I'm here speaking, yeah, that I flew in from India. Now, I flew in from India 30 years ago also to study. There was no globalization then. My country could make its economic decisions according to its own terms. I remember a dollar used to be 8 rupees in those days. In my parents' generation, a dollar used to be 4 rupees. Today, it is 45 rupees. My travel is not globalization. Us talking to each other is not globalization. Economic globalization is basically the set of rules and conditions that have been put in place in the world over the last decade, jointly by the financial institutions like the World Bank and IMF, or the trade institution like the World Trade Organization, to achieve only one objective, which is free trade or trade liberalization. Basically, no restrictions on imports, exports, investments. That free flow of capital is what economic globalization is about. And it hasn't happened as a natural phenomenon. It has been designed. Last year, when the problems were starting to brew around the World Trade Organization, those of us who had worked on its impacts, on its environmental impacts, on its social impacts, were called in by the Director General to have what they called a high-level symposium. And the high-level symposium involved, you know, people from both sides talking about free trade and the WTO rules. And there was, in the panel where I was, a Dr. Fred Bergston, who's supposed to be a very important theoretician of free trade in Washington. And he said, but Dr. Shiva, you're wrong about trying to change rules of globalization because of the bicycle theory. The bicycle theory, according to him, was basically that you can't stop a bicycle, otherwise it falls. And I had to remind him, bicycles always have riders. And when riders want to stop bicycles, they just put their foot down. And I think part of what's really happening is bicycle riders or rice planters or rice innovators are being forgotten. And in the process, what is really a project of capitalist patriarchy is being made to look like a natural process having a life of its own. Why do I call it a project of capitalist patriarchy? You know, that's Monsanto. And it's not just as a symbol. When the first corporation was formed in 1600, the East India Company, the fictitious personality that was created to incorporate a corporation was modeled on the propertied white male who were controlling the affairs of England of that time. Now, the incorporation of the East India Company as the beginning of the founding of corporations basically meant that a fictitious construction made by men with economic power was given the personality of men with economic power. And that is part of what has shaped globalization, that behind all the rules that don't speak about corporate rule, behind all the rules of the World Trade Organization, is basically sets of treaties, whether it's agriculture, whether it's trade-related intellectual property rights, or it's trade in services, or it's trade-related investment measures. Whatever you touch in the new issues of the Uruguay round of GATT, what you find is really a new set of rules that are putting the rights of capital or those who control capital above the rights of nature and all people. all species, women, the poor, working people, and their rights are either just disappearing or being deliberately erased. And the figures speak for themselves. Just look at the UNDP Human Development Reports. The world's 200 richest people have more than doubled their net worth in the last 4 years to $1 trillion. And assets of the three top millionaires are more than the combined GNP of all the least developed countries, and there's 600 million people. Even that term, net worth, is very troublesome to me, because it sounds somehow like the rest of us have no worth. And worth is basically the stocks and shares and bank accounts you control, not the people you are. And this dislocation from human beings into capital as the only embodiment of humanity is part of what globalization has actually achieved. But these figures, in economic terms, tell only a very tiny part of the story, because behind that polarization is an even deeper polarization related not to financial assets and the polarization around financial assets, but around the real assets. Real assets like land and biodiversity and water. Assets which have been basically the basis of survival for third world people and the center of women-led economies and women-centered economies around the world. If you look at biodiversity, I mentioned the seed sector. Before globalization, it was primarily a women's sector. Look at livestock, animal husbandry, female-centered. Water, who carries the pots for miles and miles? Women. And in every one of these key resources, which are the basis of women's economy, that huge inequality in financial capital is being used now to take over control over the resources that women have used to generate sustenance and survival for their communities, their families, and themselves. This little picture is telling more than this new news about Monsanto freely sharing its genomics research. You know, the genomic mapping is anyway like having a piece of paper with a cartographic map. Now, that piece of paper with a map has no meaning to it, till that map is then put on real land and used to claim this as territory and that as territory. And there's so many of you from the African region in this room. You know, every time I look at the map of Africa and I see the straight lines cut across the whole continent, I can just see the Europeans making maps, sitting in Europe, chopping it up and saying, okay, you can take this and I will take this. And since the British needed the River Gambia for slave trade, we'll keep this and the French can have the rest. That was mapping land, now they're mapping life. And the piece of paper by itself is not the important thing. It's how that piece of paper gets used to lay claim to the paddy next to it and will shape the intellectual property rights and the property rights to life forms that is the real issue.